Good afternoon and welcome everyone to this tenure information session. The session is for any tenure track candidate who will be coming up for assessment in future, whether it's the 2012-13 cohort or subsequent years. I think you'll find the information provided today will be helpful in preparing you for that process. My name is Stephen Strobel. I'm the Secretary General. You may wonder what role the Secretariat has in the process, and it does provide administrative oversight, coordination of the communication and the processing of documents. And so both as candidates and for those people here who have an administrative role in the process, you will be in touch with the office. The office will be in touch with you as you go through the process. Make sure everyone has a copy of the little blue brochure that I think is available at the front of the room. This is useful for the cohort coming up in 2012-13. It sets out the schedule and some of the deadlines. It's important that you be aware of these and pay attention to them, please. And for people who are coming up in future years, it gives you a fairly good indication of the timing as you will be going through the process in those future years. One other thing that I would just like to bring to your attention is that the tenure process follows very elaborate regulations, and we'll be getting into the regulations in much more depth in Professor White's presentation. But just to let you know that within the regulations, there are sections that pertain to the preparation and submission of documentation in support of your tenure file. There is nothing explicit in the regulations themselves pertaining to electronic submission, but we now expect and certainly strongly encourage the submission of your dossiers and supporting documents in electronic format. It is your responsibility still, as set out in the regulations, to provide the requisite number of copies. And please bear in mind that there's a package for internal assessment purposes, as well as a package that goes to the external evaluators. And we need the appropriate number of copies for each part of the process. These guidelines are available on the website should you wish to consult them, or by contacting the Secretariat, and that we could send an electronic copy. This afternoon we will have a three-part presentation. The Provo, Professor Anthony Massey, will give an overview of tenure and its importance, where it is situated in the overall sort of academic processes of the university. Professor Lydia White, the Associate Provo of Policies, Procedures, and Equity, will do a fairly careful and extensive review of the relevant regulations themselves. And also, the principal, Professor Heather Monroe Bloom, will be here to provide some high-level remarks as well. And most likely, she is unexpectedly detained, but most likely she will follow the provost's presentation. So without any further delay, I'd call on Professor Massey to give his presentation.
Thank you very much, Stephen. This is one of the most important things that we do at a university, which is the process of recruiting individuals who we want to develop and retain through the tenure process and have their careers take off at the university subsequent to that. What I want to do today, very quickly, as the Secretary General pointed out, is to review the rationale for tenure, what the privileges and responsibilities of tenure are, how the tenure process is divided into decision-making procedures and processes, think about some questions that usually need to be asked by those of you who are managing the tenure process as well as for those of you going through it, and solicit input on ways in which we can get make this process better. The details of the tenure process, which Lydia will go through, are quite important, but we'd like to streamline them, and we'd like them to be as clear as possible. One of the surveys we've undertaken at the university with not yet tenured assistant professors is a survey called COACH, which is done with in North America in about 150 or so of the largest research universities as well as at colleges, indicated that the survey at McGill indicated that we were not as clear as we could be on tenure regulations and that people need to think about them. And so we want to solicit your feedback on the ways in which this can be done. Tenure is supposed to provide fair and proper procedures for the evaluation of all academic staff on relevant criteria for teaching, for research, and for service. I'm going to start backwards, and that is to say academics with tenure should only be terminated if, and that might sound strange to start there, but it's important to remember that tenure is the most important thing we do. It is effectively a way to guarantee your academic freedom. It's a way to make sure that you're living up to your academic right obligations. And it only should be removed if there is just cause. And there have to be fair procedures for doing that. So the procedures leading to tenure are not the only procedures we have at the university. There are also procedures for ways in which it can be taken away. And in very narrow circumstances, sometimes tenure can be abolished for a bona fide financial exigency, which we hope never to have to draw on. What are some of the privileges of tenure? Well, the first one I already mentioned. Tenure provides academic freedom for researchers in terms of their teaching and their service to the university because it guarantees a certain level of economic security. It also gives individuals who have achieved tenure a stronger involvement in university life and decision-making. And there's an expectation when you get tenure that there'll be institutional support to allow you to further develop your academic careers. So tenure is a very important decision. In addition to having privileges that go along with tenure, there are also responsibilities. First, everyone who's a professor at the university or a librarian is expected to live up to their professional standards. You're supposed to make contributions to teaching or other contributions to instructional or pedagogical programs. You have to provide service. So the teaching and the research and scholarship dimensions form the three core elements that go into a tenured decision. We want to make sure that everyone understands the contributions that they have to make to the university's academic mission. But once you've achieved tenure, it's not over. Our regulations, 5.59 for academic staff and 3.59 for librarian staff, actually states that a member of the academic staff who is granted tenure shall maintain the high standards for which it was granted. So there's an expectation that this is not the end, but the beginning of a successful academic career. In the tenure process, we have to make sure that we've used the best possible frontline assurances for the quality of the individuals who are hired. We want to make sure we recruit well, that we retain individuals, and that we help them to retire from the university, the three fundamental R's of academic personnel. Second, we want to make sure that the expectations that your department has of you and your faculty, as well as the university, are clear with regard to what your pedagogical or teaching contributions are supposed to be, what your research output is supposed to look like, and what service you render to the profession, the university, or the community. It's supposed to be based on written criteria, and they will in each of the departments. There has to be a clear timetable, and that's why we're here today, as part of that. And there have to be several levels of internal review, departmental level, faculty level, principal and provost. And in addition, there's a fourth level at McGill, which would be, and hopefully none of you will need to make recourse to it, is a university appeals committee. So there must be multiple levels. They're there. There has to be a timetable. We're working that out with you today, those of you going through the cohort of 2012-13. And you have to base it on the written criteria in your department and your faculty, as well as the rules and regulations related to the tenure process at McGill. The health of a tenure system depends on sound evaluations of tenure-track faculty. The process offers you, as tenure-track faculty and librarians, the opportunity to have a constructive dialogue about where your careers over the last 5 years or so have brought you. It's also the only way in which we can guarantee fairness in terms of the process and the outcome. And it's defensible if individuals are clear about the process that they're going through. So I want to go back to emphasizing the written criteria, a clear timetable, and expectations at the three levels in which the decisions have to be made. The departmental tenure committees are urged never to pass on difficult decisions to the university tenure committee. And the university tenure committee should never pass those on to higher administrative authorities. The best decisions about tenure are taken by peers. So the trust and the working relationship that you have in your departments are very important. The criteria by which you're being evaluated, the written assessments, the working relationships, the assessment by trusted external examiners who you've agreed to with your departmental chair and the dean of the faculty all form an essential part of the way in which these procedures administratively function. Department, university, principal, provost, and there's, again, as I said, a governance procedure, which is the appeals committee. Granting tenure is the single most important decision that's made by individuals at this university. Peer review really matters, and so we want that to understand that this decision lasts a long time. Everyone, if we just looked at it in terms of assets, everyone here can expect a 30-year career post-tenure. Everyone here represents for the university, discounted over time, $5 million worth of investments. So without the capital, just the human part. So this is a really, really important decision. The tenured decisions shape the faculties and they shape the libraries. And it's the tenured professors and tenured librarians that help to define the structure of the university, because you design the pedagogical programs, you design the service components, you design the direction the university is going. Those of you who are going through the process, as well as those of you who are adjudicating the process at any level, need to ask yourself some serious questions or have questions for reflection about this tenure case. Does this person, or do you? You can ask yourself the tough questions as well, right? Do your teaching, scholarship, and service reflect the established criteria on those three dimensions of academic duties for the department, for the faculty or library, and for the university? Is the work that's been produced by the candidate representative of the highest standards that McGill holds itself to? We're a research-intensive university, but we have a strong commitment to being student-centered. So is your research at the highest quality in your field? Are you making significant contributions to the programs of study in your area? When judged by highest international standards, are we there, the peer group of universities to which we compare ourselves? And is this a good decision for you as an individual and for the department, the faculty or library, and the university? We want to make the tenure process better. We've heard in the survey that there are some issues about clarity, and we want to straighten them out. We strive for excellence, but there's always, always room for improvement. And your input really does matter. We're constantly working, and Lydia White has been working very hard to get some streamlining to these processes, but we want to strengthen the evaluation procedures and the nature of deliberations at every stage so that it's clear and transparent and you feel and your departments feel that there's natural justice in the way in which this process unfolds. Your input matters, so please don't hesitate to send comments about how to make it better or things that are not going well from the point of view of the process to provost.office@mcgill.ca. I'm going to stop there and take any questions if there are any. Or hold them till the end. In the meantime, then, let me take a moment to the principals here to introduce Heather Monroe Bloom, the principal of McGill, who comes to these meetings every year to talk to the potential candidates and the process.
Thank you, Tony, and my apologies for coming late, and I hope I don't repeat some of the things that have already been said, but I wonder if you could first show me, just by a show of hands, how many of you are here because you're facing the tenure process ahead of you? The majority of you. How many not? I think three hands. Yeah, four hands. And how many of you are facing it in the next 18 to 24 months? Okay, so some keeners are here to learn about it well in advance. Let me just begin by saying that I'm delighted we hold these sessions, and as Tony said, they really have to be sessions that do meet your needs, give you the information that you need, and help support you as you move your way through what is, I know, it's been a while since I went through it, but I remember it being an anxiety-provoking experience, and it's got a little bit of mystery around it no matter how one tries to clarify it. There's something about going through it that helps you understand fully what it means. But let me just reinforce what Tony said, and I don't know if Professor White's had a chance to speak yet or not, but we do, for all the reasons the provost has said, take tenure very seriously. It's a huge commitment on your part to come in and assume a tenure stream position as a faculty member or librarian. It's a huge commitment on the part of the public that supports the university, and for the university it does, as Tony said, define our culture, our quality, our character, and our reputation. And we're very proud. This is our 190th year anniversary as a university, founded before Quebec was a province or Canada was a country, and we're proud of what those who came before us did over the last 190 years, and we really want to, with you, build the university that 190 years from now people will be saying was as good and better than it was in its foundational period. So tenure defines a university. Without it, we are not a university. And it is well enshrined as the most effective way of protecting academic freedom, freedom of intellectual inquiry, of creating a protected environment in which debate, learning, study on any field can take place. And that's a cherished element of any healthy, vibrant society, and we're proud that the university is really the custodian of that. And along with it, as you well know, come responsibilities and accountabilities, and we work very hard to maintain our sort of autonomous governance character that allows us to define what that means to the best of our ability. And the best way to retain our autonomy is to work to the high standards for which McGill is known and that we all come here to practice in. You will hear, and it's almost rote, that tenure is based on research or scholarship, depending on your discipline, and teaching and service. And the most common question I hear is from both students and our tenure stream colleagues as well, does that really mean anything about teaching or service, or does that just really mean get your publications out, get your grants, work away as much as you can with as great intensity as you can on your research or your scholarship? And I want to say, and I want to be really clear about this, that the teaching part is absolutely critical, that your relationship with our students, the extent to which you commit yourself to taking your research and your scholarship and enriching your teaching and the experience of students with whom you interact, is absolutely key and is equal to in weight the research and scholarly contributions that you've been invited here to make. We aren't where we want to be. Research-intensive universities are known, in fact, for neglecting their undergraduate students and using their graduate students. And what we want is this to be a place where it's an enriched experience in learning and development for all of our students in the professional faculties, in graduate studies, and in undergraduate studies. And over the last 5 or 6 years, we've made a number of major undertaken a number of major initiatives to actually build that in and to create support for it. But we have further to go, and the new round of academic planning aims to create supports and opportunities for our tenure stream colleagues to do that well and to do that to the best of your ability. Service should not be an afterthought either. And there is a bit of an instinct, I think, and it's not an unhealthy one, that you don't want to overextend on the service side until you're well along in your teaching, scholarly, and research developments, because you cannot get tenure without the latter. But being a good citizen, being a strong member of your department or your faculty, and having a collegial engagement with the institution as a whole is something that actually I see uniquely at McGill, notwithstanding we've had a bit of a rock and roll fall, to be sure. But I've been associated with 6 research-intensive universities in my adult life, and I've never seen one where people so uniformly care about the place as much as themselves. And we certainly want that expressed by you, by all of our tenure stream and tenured colleagues in the relationship with the students. One of the most common complaints I hear from our students, who, by the way, are widely regarded as at the undergraduate level as representing the best undergraduate student body anywhere in North America, the complaint they most often have is that they don't know a professor well enough to get a letter of reference written for them when they graduate from the university. That's not something we're proud of, and everything you can do to redress that will be welcome. So we've talked a lot, and I heard the provost talk a lot about sort of the expectations and the responsibilities and the elements of what goes into getting tenure. But I really want to say as well, it's our job to be supporting you as you go through this. And this forum is important for you to raise questions in, to ask, you know, if there are no bad questions, there are no dumb questions. It is complicated. As I say, there's mystery around it. But the other is to not see this as the only way you're going to get the information and help that you need to be successful in this pursuit, successful in determining, is this a place you want to go for tenure? And if it is, how to do that in a way that's successful. So please ask us for help. I know Professor White is here in that capacity. I know that both at the departmental and faculty level, it's a strong commitment of the administration, the academic leadership, to support you. And you cannot succeed without being able to ask for help and expect to receive it as well. So with that, I just want to wish you luck, but say this should be, if this is your first formal moment at the institutional level of really engaging with the process, make it the beginning of a process and look to us to be helpful to you with it. Thank you very much.
I'm happy, Professor White, to stick around.
Oh, yes.
That is the one that has the stuff in it. Let's get rid of this. Okay, so I'm going to give you a bit more detail about what's involved in the tenure process, particularly oriented towards those of you that are coming up for tenure next year. But the process doesn't change all that much from year to year, so if you're not due to, for tenure till later, the things that I have to say will nevertheless be relevant. So I've just said that. And just to draw your attention to the fact that most of what I'm saying will be relevant to assistant professors, but some of what I'll have to say is also relevant for assistant librarians, and we will be doing a special session for the librarians next term. So there are two sets of regulations depending which category you fall into, and it's very important to become familiar with those regulations, and they're available from the Secretariat website. Let me just mention about mandatory tenure consideration. So if you're an assistant professor or librarian, your mandatory year of consideration is in your sixth year of appointment. If you are an associate professor or librarian, it's in your fifth year, and if you're a full professor, the last two, obviously, categories without tenure, it's in your fourth year. But you can, there is such a thing as early tenure consideration. So if you are an assistant professor or a librarian, you can ask from your third year on to be considered for early tenure, and if your department chair wishes and you agree, that consideration could take place even earlier. Associate and full professors and librarians can actually ask at any time. And let me make it clear, I'm not sure whether it's on the next slide or not. If you decide to go up for early tenure consideration and you're not successful, you do get another kick at the can in your mandatory year of tenure consideration. Another thing to mention is that there are certain types of leave, maternity and other parental leaves, leaves of absence, disability leaves. If they're longer than 3 months, you can make a choice as to whether you want to, in a sense, ignore them or whether you want them to be taken into consideration, in which case you will actually be put into a later tenure cohort. At the moment, the regulations say you must inform the provost's office by August 31st of the year in which you would normally be considered. This is awfully late, considering that the dossier is due on September the 1st. So one of the things I highly recommend if you're in that situation is that you inform us at some point during the summer before what would be your normal year of consideration. As the provost has already mentioned and the principal, tenure is assessed on the basis of performance of certain academic duties. I'll do the duties for the professoriate first and then the librarians. So teaching, this is undergraduate teaching, graduate teaching, and so on. Research or other scholarly activities, creative activities in certain faculties. And then the other contributions that are normally known as service. In the case of librarians, it's slightly different. You have what are called position responsibilities. And then the other two are somewhat similar, professional and scholarly activities. This can include research and other contributions, in other words, service. Now, it's very important for you to understand that the getting yourselves ready for tenure is your responsibility. People will help you and remind you, but ultimately you must take charge. So you must make sure that you have met the requirements, or rather that you can establish in your dossier, we'll talk about in a moment, that you've met the requirements. It's up to you to put the dossier together. We'll talk about the dossier a bit more in a moment. So the criteria are going to be focusing on your performance in academic duties. The standard that's required is as follows. Superior in two categories of academic duties and reasonable in a third. And in the case of librarians, they have actually got to show superior performance in position responsibilities. In the case of the professoriate, it's not the case that that there's any one category where you must show superior, at least not as far as the regulations are concerned. I might talk about that more if there are any questions later. The important thing as far as tenure is concerned, and this is different from reappointment, is that what matters is your performance in your years at McGill. So promise is no longer enough, whereas promise is, well, not enough, but certainly a major contributor to reappointment decisions. And it's your performance while you were on tenure track at McGill, so supposing you came, as many of you will have, with outstanding performance before you even got here, that's not enough now for tenure at McGill. It's what you've done while you're here that matters, unless you're going up for early tenure, in which case the tenure committees do indeed look back at what you did before. The other thing that has to be considered is, you know, your global record while you're at McGill on tenure track, so all the duties and all the years. So if you have, you know, one fantastically good year and a couple of very bad years, the good year is not going to necessarily be able to compensate for the bad years. And another thing that's very important is, remember we've got three categories of academic duties. You can't sort of say, oh, I am fantastic in my category of research, not so good in teaching. I hope the fact that I am highly superior in research will compensate for teaching. It will not. I will talk about something else that's related to that in a moment. But each category has to be considered on its own merits. And the other thing is that you will have certain situations where things that you do, it's not quite clear to you, is this research or is this service? Is this research or is this teaching? And at some point, when you're preparing your dossier, you'll have to make a choice. A common example is if you do reviewing for academic journals. This could be part of your research if what you're reviewing especially relates to your own research, but it clearly also could be counted as service. You can count it as one or other, but not both. That's what no double counting means. And you may need to be strategic in deciding what these borderline cases, where to put them, because, and you should consult with people and ask them. Once you've made the decision, your tenure review committees can't change what you've decided, even if they think you made the wrong choice. So discuss beforehand. Don't hope that one of the tenure committees would say, oh, this would be much better in research, and that'll make his or her research look better. They're not allowed to do that. Okay, so the dossier itself. The main component of the dossier is prepared by you and must be submitted not later than September 1st of your year of tenure consideration. It includes your CV. It includes a personal statement by you that covers the various aspects of your work. And then the crucial things that deal with the academic duties. So it must include a record of your research and related activities, a record of your teaching. And at the moment, we have in the regulations a teaching portfolio that gives you some suggestions of how to present this. And I'll say something about that in a moment when I put up the third one, and then record of your general contributions to the university. So the provost mentioned that there are certain ways in which we could certainly improve the tenure process for you. And one of these is that we only give you guidance on teaching portfolio. There is nothing in the regulations that suggests to you how to organize the research and service parts of your dossier, and we're working on that. And the other thing to say is that the teaching portfolio may, as currently worded, seem to overwhelm you with the amount of stuff you're supposed to put in it. And there's probably too much that's in there, and again, we're working on maybe reducing how much exactly needs to go into the teaching portfolio. You do not need to put in all your course outlines, for example, even though the portfolio seems to imply that that might be a good idea. So, if in doubt, consult about this. But we are aware that there's much clearer information that we could be giving you, and whether, unfortunately, this probably won't be, the changes won't be ready in time for those of you that are going up for tenure next year, but certainly by the year after. And there may be other materials that you want to submit and include in your dossier. Then, after September 1st, things can be added to the dossier, mostly by other people, but also a little bit by you. So the first thing that gets added afterwards is reports of the external evaluators. I'll be talking about them in a moment. The chair of your departmental tenure committee can add material before November the 15th, and anything that's added is copied to you. You, the candidate, may add, with certain limitations, may add material up till November the 15th. The most common material to add is if, when you submitted your dossier, you say in your research component that you have submitted a paper for publication, and between September the 1st and the 15th, you hear that it's been accepted, then this is clearly extra information that you want your committees to know. So that's the type of thing that you can add. Sometimes your committees will request you to add additional, will request additional material from you, and that can be added after November 15th. So let's just turn to the external evaluators. Their job is to evaluate your research and scholarship, and sometimes your service. They do not look at your teaching. They must be clearly recognized scholars in the relevant field, so qualified to evaluate you. They must not be at McGill, and they mustn't be in a conflict of interest with you, and obviously there are various kinds of conflicts of interest, your former supervisor, people with whom you have personal relationships, and so on. And there are three evaluations, and it's the Secretary General who deals with actually obtaining these evaluations, and only the Secretary General or his office may communicate with the evaluators. And you are not, neither you nor the committees, with one exception which we'll get to, can approach other evaluators from outside McGill to sort of say, well, can we boost the dossier even more with other people? The answer is no. However, the University Tenure Committee is allowed to approach evaluators other than the three that got selected out of a list of names that you yourselves have approved, and I'll be talking about in a moment. So there are three levels of review, the Departmental Tenure Committee, the University Tenure Committee, and then the principal, who normally delegates this function to the provost. The Departmental Tenure Committee is obviously the committee that's closest to you, and the chair of that committee is normally the head of the academic unit, so the chair or director or the dean, sorry, not the dean in small faculties, I'll get to that. Yeah.
On the principal and provost, the principal actually reads all of the
tenure. Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. Okay, both, not one or the other. Apologies. The DTC has a minimum membership of four tenured members plus the chair. Tenured, I said that. And no individual can be on can be both on your departmental tenure committee and your university tenure committee. The university tenure committee is normally chaired by the dean. It consists of six members, five plus that dean. And the dean, they're what are called faculty lists, which the deans have put together under approved procedures. The dean chooses two people from that list. And then there's a Senate list, again, put together, approved by Senate under recognized procedures. and the Secretary General chooses which three members from that list will go on your UTC. UTC members cannot be from your department. If you're in a joint appointment, you've basically got two units feeding into the process. So the chair has to be determined by both the department chairs. They have to decide which of them is going to chair. They have to jointly choose the membership of the DTC. And if you have an appointment in two faculties, both deans have to be involved in determining who's going to chair the UTC. And again, the faculty members of the on the UTC are determined by both deans. But the Secretary General still appoints the Senate list. It's very important, obviously, that the committees, in fact, the Provost has already mentioned this, must be guided by impartiality, fairness, objectivity. That's what they're there for. And they will be basing their recommendations on how you've done in your academic duties. And what they'll be considering is basically your dossier, which will be before them. And when they've reached their finished their deliberations, they must provide reasons, and in fact, a report supporting whatever their assessment has been. And this report must cover all academic duties. So the committees may make unanimous recommendations, and I would say that's by far the most common situation. But sometimes you'll get committees making a majority report and perhaps one minority, and very rarely more than one minority report. So in those cases, the decision is not unanimous, but nevertheless, the whole committee must have seen all versions of the report, so the majority and the minority reports, and they must all be submitted at the same time. In other words, no member of your committee can decide a week after the report's been turned in, oh, I don't agree with what was turned in, I'm now going to write a minority report and submit it. That is not permitted. And all members of the committee must sign the relevant reports. So now I'm going to talk about the timetable, and I've divided it into three phases. Phase one is the one where you have the most involvement and the most control. Phase two is going to be about the departmental tenure committee mostly, and phase three about the university tenure committee. So in phase one, in mid-April, if you are one of those people thinking about going up for early tenure, you have to let somebody know. And you have to let your chair know and your dean know, and then they will forward the information. And then by early May, the dean will be informing the Secretary General of which candidates are going up for tenure, either mandatory or early tenure. And following that, you and the chair of the DTC agree on a list of 8 external evaluators. And by June 15th, you submit to your chair your CV. This is not the final version. You can update it for submission to in your dossier later on. So your CV and the list of externals goes to the dean, and it also goes to the UTC, and it's the UTC that decides on a ranking for the externals, and then the Secretary General will approach them according to that ranking. As I've already mentioned, if you want to what we call stop the tenure clock, you must have done so by August 31st, and please do it earlier than that if you're faced with that situation. So by September the 1st, this is the first of the critical deadlines, you must have been informed of the composition of your committees. The chair of the UTC must have sent the ranked list so that the Secretary General can contact the externals. And crucially, you must have submitted to the Secretary General, I'll put both these up, what we call the internal package and the external package of your dossier. And the only difference is that the external package excludes the teaching component. And indeed, this should be electronic submission. We have not yet got a system where you can literally do this sort of online yourselves. Rather, we ask that you bring sufficient CDs or memory sticks with your whole dossier on it, which will then be circulated to the various committees and the externals. So they will get electronic versions of your dossiers. So at that point, you can sort of sit back and maybe not completely relax, but at least you've done the main thing that you have to do, that is, you submitted your dossier. So the second phase, which is basically from September to January, at some point during this period, the Departmental Tenure Committee meets, and they probably meet several times. They don't necessarily meet in September. It's that committee decides when their meetings are going to be. It's just that they have a deadline in January by which they have to report. So to get these meetings going, the Secretary General makes sure that the DTC and indeed the UTC have your dossier, make sure that the external evaluators have your dossier, and then by November the 15th, this is the deadline already mentioned, when people, including you, can add stuff to the dossier. But by the way, nothing that gets added after September 1st goes to the externals. So it's only the internal committees that will see that. After November the 15th, as already mentioned, you might be asked to add some more. By November the 25th, the Secretary General, ideally, is able to transmit the external reports to your committees. So the DTC is working, looking at your dossier and preparing a report. And the third phase, which is the winter term, the UTC is meeting. And again, they may meet several times and not necessarily every month. But by January the 25th, they will DTC will have reported on you, and that report will go to the UTC. The UTC might ask for further information from your tenure committee or from other external evaluators from that list. And then by April the 30th, the UTC has to submit their report to the Secretary General. That report goes to the principal, it goes to you, and it goes back to the chair of the DTC. And then during the months of May and June, the principal and the provost are making their decisions and recommendations to the Board of Governors. And if they're tending to a negative, this decision will be communicated to you. So let me just tell you a little bit about this tending to the negative, because it can happen at all levels. So if any committee or the principal or provost is tending towards a negative decision in your case, the candidate must be informed in writing and you must be given the reasons. You must be given access, or you will be given access, to the external evaluators' reports with all nominative information removed. And you must be given a reasonable time to prepare a response, because you are given the opportunity to address in person the concerns that have been given to you in writing. And you're allowed to bring an advisor of your choice to any meeting that you have with any of the committees or the principal or the provost. Now, let's make it clear that most of you will not be facing this situation. Most of you will be looking for a positive outcome. And let me also say that even if at some point on the way you did get a tending to the negative letter, You still have control over that situation. You do have the opportunity to address the committee's concerns, and I would strongly urge you to do so. Don't just say, I give up. Okay. Because in many cases, in fact, probably the majority of cases, candidates are able to persuade the committees that why tending to a negative is not the right decision in their case. So you do have a real say if this happens to you. You'll be informed of a positive outcome by the end of May or early June. You'll be informed about tending to the negative earlier than that. So actually, at this time, no news is good news. And if you are successful, you'll be tenured from June the 1st. If you are not successful, your appointment may continue for up to 1 year. And also, as the provost has already mentioned, there are appeal procedures available to you, which are also described in the regulations that I suggested you become familiar with. But don't worry about the appeal procedures at this point. So just to wind up, don't allow yourselves to be intimidated by this process. It is within your control. Of course, it's stressful. I don't think we can deny that. But you can make it less stressful and less intimidating, especially by starting early. Don't leave preparing your dossier till next summer if you're going up for if your year of mandatory consideration is next year. You know, start now if you haven't already. At the very least, make sure that your CV is up to date. Keep it running. I would recommend always keeping your CVs up to date so that you're not frantically scrabbling around at the last minute trying to remember which conferences you went to and that kind of thing. And you can also start thinking about how am I going to draft my statement about my various academic duties. So there are lots of things you can do in advance so that you don't have a great build-up of pressure in the 3 months before your dossier is due. Of course, you've probably got more time at that time, but start thinking about it now. So that's what all that was about. So was that. And very important, don't be afraid to ask for advice. Ask your chair. Ask your colleagues, especially perhaps colleagues who've recently been through the tenure process, members of your tenure committees. And especially, please feel free to ask me. So, one of the things that I'm there for is to help you interpret any aspect of the regulations. My email is there. Last year after this presentation, I had lots of people emailing me, asking me for information, for clarification, and I will usually try and respond, within the next 24 hours. Again, perhaps not if you do this on August 31st, but if you start asking me questions now, I'm there for you as far as this whole process is concerned. And now we have basically, unless the Secretary General wants that, do you want to add any more? No? The rest of this session is for you to ask questions, and any of the three of us will be happy to answer. Yes.
Hi, yes, I was hired in January, not in September. So it was January 2008. So that means I have till September 2013?
If you hired in January, you have to count the process starts on June 1st of the year that you were hired. So actually, yeah, I hate doing these mathematical calculations about tenure on the spur of the moment, but basically it's as if you were hired any time in 2008, so you're going to start, your clock is going to start, I think, later. But that's the kind of thing you can email me about and I'll confirm it exactly. Yeah. Sorry. If
people didn't hear my response. If you start at any, the tenure calculations start from June 1st of the year in which you were appointed. So this will make, depending on whether you were appointed before or after, will make a slight difference, but not much.
So the external reviewers, they can be from Canada or any country in the world?
They can be from any country in the world. The important thing is that they are recognized experts in their field, and that they are their field is, you know, such that they can assess your how you've been doing. Yeah.
Yes. What exactly is the difference in the between the UTC and the DTC? I mean, do they look at the same thing, and the UTC just checks that the DTC may make a mistake, or?
That's an interesting question. So they do look at the same material, that is to say, your dossier. The UTC also looks at the DTC's report. The DTC is the committee that's closest to you. It consists of members of your own department, or if you're a joint appointment, your two departments. So on the one hand, those people are probably closest to you in terms of your area of research and in terms of the kind of teaching that you will be doing and so on. On the other hand, they may not have the university-wide experience. And what are the university's expectations as opposed to the unit's expectations? And so the UTC brings breadth. Because, in fact, the UTC will have members who are not necessarily as close to your own research area as the DTC is, but they are drawn from across the university precisely to provide, I hate this term, but quality control, to consistency across the university.
Does this work? It is? Yeah? Oh, okay. So the articles that were published sort of in between when I graduated, when I finished grad school, but before I started officially at McGill, do I completely exclude them from the dossier, or they're just discounted? I wasn't sure.
I would never exclude anything. It's for the committee really to decide how much weight they're going to give to them, but at least don't exclude them from your CV. On the other hand, if you're going to be submitting a lot of published articles, again, I think don't feel you've got to submit every single thing that you've published. Some dossiers are like that because of that. Much better to choose select articles that really represent where you think you've made a major contribution and that you link to in your statement. It's difficult to say include, exclude the earlier stuff. It should certainly be on your CV. But probably not in the form of actual PDF files. But, you know, if you can show that there's a progression from what you did before to where you are now, a trajectory where it's useful for the committee to see that, then they belong in the dossier. So there's not one answer to this question, actually. Don't rely on them, that's the answer.
Can you explain how it works if we're in a faculty that has no departments?
So in a faculty without departments, there is still what we call a departmental tenure committee. So it's still called a DTC, and there is still a UTC, University Tenure Committee. The issue is, what does the dean do? The dean doesn't chair the DTC, but the UTC and some other faculty member, tenured faculty member, is chosen as chair of the DTC. Apart from that, it's the same. But when I said no person can be on both a DTC and a UTC, that includes deans.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on the teaching dossier? What are the expectations?
The expectations for the teaching dossier, as I say, they are described in the regulations. The idea is that you're asked to present things like your teaching philosophy. And this is one of the areas where we think you could perhaps provide less information than has been customary. So we've had people writing sort of 10 pages on their teaching philosophy, and that's probably more than is required. But some sense of how you approach teaching, you know, what you're aiming to achieve and so on. You need to report on the courses that you've taught. People typically give a summary of the course evaluations and a comparative summary. It's very useful to show how you've done over several years. If you've had weaker course evaluations in earlier years, and you can show that they're progressively getting stronger, this is a good thing to do in the dossier. If you're involved in graduate student supervision, sort of a list of who your students are, where they are, I mean, you know, are they still students or have they gone on? Maybe one course outline and so on, especially if it's, if you've been involved in innovation in terms of new courses and so on, you can really talk about that and give us an example. There are lots of other suggestions in the dossier, which I can't remember for the moment. Can you think of any, Tony?
I think another is this: if you've made contributions to the design of pedagogical programs in your area, and the ways in which you've approached it, if you've been innovative, as Lydia said, in using and bringing new approaches to teaching that haven't been used in your area before, the extent to which you work with students on new technology uses in the classroom, ways in which you've designed courses individually or as a program, those are all part of contributions to the pedagogy of the university. So it's not just, it shouldn't be viewed narrowly as just how well you've been evaluated by students. That's a very important input, but it's not the whole thing. It's your contributions, improvement over time, innovations, course design, curricula design. All of those count.
Yeah, that's a question of what goes where, but teaching only inside the university, also outside the university?
So again, this will depend on a case-by-case basis, but certainly, and also if you're talking about before you got here or if you're teaching outside and you are here, you should probably include that. And you should certainly, for example, a number of people may be supervising graduate students at other universities, but it's part of your teaching. So yes, those things should be included. Okay.
It's important to think about where you put it, because sometimes if you're teaching in a summer school that's a specifically designed for your profession, then it's a service contribution to your profession, and you only get to count it once. So if you want it in your teaching, it's there. If you prefer it to be in your service, then it's there. But those kinds of external activities are important contributions to your profession. They may enhance your teaching here, but we're mostly interested in what you've done to make McGill a better place in terms of your pedagogy.
Okay. Couple of questions. How widely do you interpret service? Is it service to the general community or strictly on university committees? And secondly, the UTC, is it a candidate-specific committee, or is AUTC looking at a number of dossiers?
I'll answer the second question first. Normally, both the level of DTC, if there are several people going up for tenure in the same year, and certainly at the level of UTC, these are not candidate specific. Right? So the committees will be looking at the cohort. Now, in some cases, there may be conflicts of interest or whatever, which mean that membership of one or other committee has to be slightly changed for a particular person. But in principle, they're not candidate-specific. Your first question is a very good one, and I was just thinking nobody's asked about service. Service can be interpreted in various ways. So on the one hand, you mentioned university committees, and it's not just university committees. It's, university committees, faculty committees, departmental committees, things you do for your department that are not committee work, you know, if you're the undergraduate advisor, all those kinds of things count as service. Some of you may, as Tony mentioned before, you may be involved in service to a profession outside of McGill. You may be, and I gave the example earlier, you may be reviewing articles or research grants for organizations, journals, funding councils outside of McGill. Those would all count as service. And then, or you may, in fact, be involved in the community outside McGill in Montreal doing various community-type activities. Those would also count as service. Tony wants to add something.
So I think that's true, but you want to make sure that this is a tenure for being an academic. So the service component should be related to the ways in which you, it's not just being a good citizen by being on voluntary organizations. It's service in the contribution of the governance of the university or the professional community to which you belong, or bringing that expertise, that specific expertise, into the community. So the narrowness is about, tenure is about your academic duties. So it's again, the contributions outside the university depend, the service component should be reflective of who you are as an academic.
Just to clarify, and don't make the assumption that I'm a last-minute person from this question, we have a right to submit additional things up until the 15th. Does that mean that our departmental committee must meet after that date, or do they have a right to meet before that date?
This is a very interesting question, because basically it's not clear, right? So, and in fact, at certain points in the regulations, you'll see things that say blah, 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 provided that the committee has not already done such and such. But I would say it's very unusual for a departmental committee to, it's not unusual for them to meet before November 15th, but it's very unusual for them to have finished by November 15th. So it's unlikely that you'd be in the situation where you add something and the committee says, sorry, we've already made up our minds. And even if they have, your information will still go to the next committee.
I just have some clarifications needed around when you're supervising graduate students, master's and PhD students. I guess that falls under teaching, but a lot of that work also involves spending a lot of time helping them secure research funding and research grants. If that's been a large part of your work, does that fall under research or teaching, or do you have to decide which camp it's going to fall into?
You have to decide. And I'm not sure, I suppose, I can suggest how you can divide it up. You can have a sort of mentoring component, which is the helping them with grants and stuff like that. And that could be service, and then you have true supervision of their...
Service or research?
Well, sorry.
If they're getting research, okay.
But again, it's up to you. But what I'm saying is there's this issue of not double counting, but you can divide the teaching aspect of graduate supervision from the other aspects, which you then could put into service or research. And it's going to be your choice where they go, but it's very difficult to make these decisions. It's a good idea to consult, and for these kinds of decisions, to consult within your unit. Talk to your chair. Where do you suggest I put this?
I think that the overflow issue that Lydia pointed out is very important. You have to make some choices. Certainly, if you're publishing with your graduate students, it's going to be part of your research. But at the same time, you're helping them form their careers and you're supervising. That's not double counting, right? Because you're saying, I've supervised someone to a degree. That's my teaching contribution. But that person with me has published articles. That's your research contribution. If they've also published on their own, that's you've helped them as a teacher. You have it. It's not your research contribution. It's theirs. So you have to, but you have to make a decision about where graduate supervision and the components of it fit into your dossier. So that's why there's this latitude. We really do want to give every candidate the opportunity to make her or his best case. And as Lydia pointed out, it's your responsibility in the first instance to make that case. So get good advice, talk to people, don't be afraid to ask, but think about what's going to make your dossier the strongest. If you don't need it in the research because you published a lot and you haven't been doing a lot of teaching, you may decide, well, look, all my graduate supervision really belongs here. That's your choice. And then the committee must assess it on the basis of your judgment as to what you want it to count for.
Let me say, I have had questions from DTCs and UTCs in the past saying, we think this person made a mistake in where they put, you know, X. Can we move it? And the answer is no. So you do need to make the right decision.
Any of the committees, DTC or UTC, they discuss the candidate just once?
No, okay. they may discuss a candidate many times. It's as often as they feel the need. I mean, yeah, no. So it's usually not the case that a DTC would deal with a candidate in one meeting, for example.
The external evaluators. What exactly is the conflict of interest? I mean, there are some obvious things, but, I mean, for collaborators or previous collaborators, are there any rules? Or?
So I think what we do for previous collaborators is there's a certain time beyond which we say, okay, that's no longer a conflict of interest. And I think the rule of thumb is 6 years, is it? Yeah, 6 years, I think. So if they've collaborated within 6 years, you shouldn't put them. Now, for some of you, this may raise a problem if you're in a very small field. When you choose your list of eight together with your chair, you also have to give a justification. Why is this person a suitable person? So there would be the opportunity to say, you know, even though I collaborated with this person 4 years ago, here are the reasons why this might be a suitable choice. So there is a chance to express those kinds of issues, but on the whole, you should try and find other people.
It's very important. So listing individuals who you believe are capable of assessing objectively the dossier for your research in particular, and that's really what they're assessing. You disclose that you've had a collaboration 5 years ago. That's a disclosure. It's on the form. Then the dean will make a determination as to whether or not that is sufficient distance to accept it. Another thing is you really want to look to people who will have an impact on those of us who read the dossiers who are not experts. Because your field is, they're going to assess, the expertise is being assessed at the DTC level and by these external evaluators. But it does matter, and someone asked before, where they come from. It does have an impact. But their status in the field is more important than the university in which they work. So you want to make sure that you've chosen people who've had an impact on the field and who can talk about your impact through your scholarship and research on the field. So it doesn't matter as much where they teach or where they're working as what their individual status is. But the shorthand is usually peer universities have people who we know can assess quite well. The other thing is the level. It's never a good idea to say, to have someone, I didn't write a paper with this person, but I was a graduate student with them. That wouldn't be the same level of distance. It's too close in age. It doesn't give the distance that's needed to have a true assessment. And it doesn't matter whether you have agreed or not with individuals in publications, some of those things, as long as you think they can be objective. It's important to have a really good list that you've agreed to with your chair and that the dean can approve. Disclose any contacts, because if it comes up after, it doesn't look good at all in terms of a kind of character assessment. We found something that you didn't disclose, that you'd published an article 3 years ago, or you didn't tell us that on the form, but when you've submitted your publications, we see that this is the same person. What?
Will you start collaborating after September
15th? Well, it's a little late. They're going back 5 years. So I think it's better to think about that, who's had an impact on your field, who you think you've made an impression on, and who you don't know necessarily personally. Now, if you've sat on a panel with someone, you can say that. That's not going to be a conflict, right? If you have both presented papers at a conference together, if you have both published chapters in a book edited by someone else, that's not necessarily going to be a problem. But disclose it.
Yes, and to add to that, quite often, if you haven't disclosed, the person who does disclose is the external, who sort of says, oh, I know this person from whatever. So there are various ways in which, you know, people can be caught out if they don't. So, yeah, you have the opportunity to disclose, so use that opportunity.
So, for example, like, maybe, it's the same question. It's if we are involved in the like big national project, and most of the expertise in the Canada who is in the my field is in the same project, and can I suggest them as one of the external reviewer?
They're in the same project, but not at McGill.
Not McGill.
I think this is a case where you need to talk to your chair about this, or maybe talk to me. I mean, normally I would say you should really avoid these people. But if there isn't anybody else with the expertise, then you know, this is something that needs to be considered. And again, you would have to declare up front why, both that they're in the same project and why only somebody in that project is suitable to assess you.
About a chair of a DTC, what's happening if there's a change of chairs of the unit between the start and the end of the evaluation process?
Yes, this happens quite often. So if there's a change in chair, and if it's somebody coming from outside who's not familiar with McGill procedures, what I've suggested in the couple of cases that came up in the last year or so is that they actually appoint as the chair of the DTC some experienced tenured member of the senior professor in the department. And I know in at least one case where that was done. If it's a change of chair within, you know, they're both in the department, both at McGill, they'll both be familiar with the procedures. Now, but one thing that you may be thinking of is what happens if the change of chair is such that you draw up your list of eight names with one person, but then the person who comes to chair your committee is another person, and really it doesn't matter. So long as, because that's really the only split that's likely to affect you, since chairs usually start in the summer. But there is another issue, which is what happens if the chair or any other member of the committee, after they've started deliberating, for whatever reason, is no longer able to serve. And the regulations are very clear about the steps to be taken. First of all, these committees have alternate members, but if the committees have actually met and begun serious deliberations, you can't insert an alternate. You just carry on with whatever is left of the committee. Whereas if somebody has to drop out before they've started, then an alternate gets put in. And so it could be an alternate chair.
about asking for a, is it a conflict of interest if there's someone who's very senior in my field, I have not collaborated with them, have not taken classes from them, but he does know my work and has written letters for me. I cannot put him on the list, right?
I was going to say, actually, you can, but there's somewhere, I think you have to declare that they've done letters for you, but you could.
The dossier can include, so those are not solicited letters. A dossier can include information that you think is relevant, but it might be a conflict if that person has already written on your behalf and it's on been used elsewhere, including to get the job at McGill, for example. So then you'd really want to make sure that you can include those as testimonials part of a dossier on attesting to your research, but you probably should choose someone else because that person may be excluded, and then you've used up one of your degrees of freedom on getting a good list.
Thinking again about evaluators, I'm thinking of someone who has moved from, is no longer teaching, but has moved from the university out to a, you know, professional life, if you will, has crossed that boundary of non-academic and academic. Is that suitable?
If that person is qualified to assess you, the fact that they may have moved out of academia should not matter. Again, it's something you should probably, say, make it clear what their previous position was. You don't lose the ability to make judgments about a field just because you've changed where you work. So that shouldn't be a problem.
And this is just a comment. I suppose an analogous situation would be a highly esteemed member of academia who has retired.
Absolutely, and we certainly don't exclude retirees as letter writers. Yeah.
Can students, former students, write letters for your teaching dossier?
Can students and former students write letters for the teaching dossier? Yes. And that's not uncommon to have students do that. Especially, it's probably more common for graduate students than undergraduates, but either is okay. Either is done. Yeah.
I assume you'll have access to those PowerPoint slides, or could we have access to your PowerPoint slides?
They will be posted on the Secretariat webpage fairly soon, right?
Hopefully by Monday.